Hey there, it's Virginia. Listen, NHBR, word of mouth included, is supported by you, our listeners, to the tune of 40% of our annual revenue. It's what makes us what we are, and you can help. The support button is at the top of the page at nhpr.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. I'm a dog person. There, I said it. So any article or book about dogs that arrives in our office, I'm usually the first, usually the only one to see its potential as a radio story. Lucky for listeners, my colleagues keep me on a pretty short leash. See what I did there? But it's not often that I stumble across a story like the one I found in this month's Mental Floss magazine. It's a profile of Alexandra Horowitz, who earned her PhD in cognitive science and teaches psychology at Barnard College. Somewhere along the line, though, Alexandra turned her attention to the peculiar thinking of dogs, and she's done meticulous research and studied experiments that led to her writing a book, Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. I'll try to refrain myself from asking too many questions about my own dogs as I welcome Alexandra to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Rebecca. Glad to be here.
Okay, so talk about what made you turn that way, to take a look at the thinking that dogs do.
Well, in grad school, I was studying and interested in animal minds. And anyone who does this is always looking at behaviors that animals display, which we might be able to connect to mental abilities, since animals are never telling us what they know or think. We have to figure it out from their behavior. What a behavior does by an animal demonstrates that he understands what I'm saying or realizes how to deceive or appreciates something about the world and so forth. And I got interested in play behavior because human play is a great forum for learning all sorts of things about others' minds. There's a lot of pretend play in among children, and it's a really developmentally rich time. Most researchers look at primates if they're studying animals, but I realized I had a pretty interesting subject right in my home, who I was watching play three times a day when we went out to walk together. And so I started taking my video camera with me to watch my dog and other dogs play, and I started then studying dogs, and I've never looked back.
You know, that was one of the more interesting parts of the book to me, that slowing down of that footage watching dogs play. Mm. I have two dogs. I think of them playing. It looks like they're doing like a cage match fight. There's teeth baring, rolling around, lots of growling. What is actually going on there?
Right. Well, play is a really rambunctious, high-paced activity, which is actually very safe. In other words, it rarely leads to fights, actually. But it uses all the behaviors that dogs have in their toolbox, everything from aggressive behaviors to sexual behaviors to friendly behaviors to predatory behaviors to fearful behaviors. So they're showing everything that they've got, but they're doing it in this safe context where they've started with a play signal to each other, which means something like, I want to play, or I'm about to play, or do you want to play with me? And after that signal, all bets are off. They can do anything, and it's in a safe context.
That's the signal where they put their paws down on the ground and stick their rump back up in the air, right?
Yeah.
I think we've all seen that.
The play bow, right.
Yeah. One of the things you look at early in the book is the way we tend to anthropomorphize dogs. When they have a guilty look on their face, for instance, we think they feel guilty. And if they avoid going out in the rain, we assume they don't like the rain, and we make them wear little raincoats. Mm-hmm. What are we missing when we burden dogs with our own human definitions of their feelings?
I think we're missing pretty much everything. We miss the possibility of seeing who the dog really is if we just consider him to be a small, furrier human. I want to say, I think it's very natural to anthropomorphize. I see what looks like pride in my dog's bearing and gait when he's found a really good ball in the grasses, say. But I think that anthropomorphisms are really limiting. In other words, they represent a limitation on our imagination, our inability to imagine that animals could be anything but just smaller, inferior versions of ourselves. And of course, that's simply wrong. Many animals have quite interesting abilities that surpass humans. And so I've been studying, actually, some of these anthropomorphisms we make of dogs, like that guilty look, to see if their behavior really demonstrates that they have the same internal state as we do.
Well, let's talk about one of those. One of them that you talk about a lot is the face licking that we call dogs kissing. Like, what is that?
The kissing behavior is a kind of fabulous example, as we call it a kiss, right, when they lick our face, and it feels affectionate, and it certainly feels like a greeting when we've been gone and the dog licks us. But if you look at wolf behavior, and of course dogs and wolves share a common ancestor, you get a slightly different sense of what that kiss is. When a wolf returns to the pack from a hunt, all the other wolves mob and swarm around the returning hunter, and they lick him or her around the face. It's a greeting, to be sure, but it's also a request that the hunting animal regurgitate a little bit of that food, which they usually do, you know, and all the other animals consume it. So your dog might be greeting you, might love you, but also is kind of interested in that sandwich you had for lunch.
That sounds incredibly familiar. We're getting a glimpse inside the brains of my favorite animal, dogs. Our guest is Alexandra Horowitz. Her background shifted from the study of human cognition to dogs, and she's the author of a really fascinating book called Inside of a Dog. You were just talking about wolf behavior, and one of the things you hear a lot that trainers say is that when you're working with your own dog, you have to think of it like you're a pack. Your family is a pack, and you have to assert your dominance over the dog. But you're right that that's not quite what it's like for the dogs that live with us, right?
Yeah, there's an important difference. The idea of a pack came from wolves, of course, and wolves do live in packs. But research on wolves has now clearly shown that these packs are families, not competitive groups of wolves all vying to be alpha or on top. Instead, there are parents and then their pups and maybe generations of their pups. So the parents are alphas, in the vernacular that some trainers, not all trainers by any means, use. But no one is trying to wrest control from the parents. Our dogs must think of the pack that they've wound up in as their family, and we should treat them the same way. You know, we can call them us a pack, but it really is a family, and we absolutely do not need to be the alpha or to make them to submit. In fact, I think it's a horrible way to live with a dog. It's terrifying for them, and it's not rewarding for the people either.
You also point out a key difference between dogs and wolves is that dogs make eye contact with people. Mm. Why do they do that?
Well, it might be that we, way back, selected for the dogs who were not afraid of looking us in the face. And right now, as it turns out, dogs as a species are the only non-human animals who will look us in the eyes and not have it be a threat or allow us to look at them and not to always feel threatened. Most other animals use eye contact as a threat. Say a wolf will look at another wolf who's in his territory, and it helps rebuff that wolf and avoid a fight. But obviously, people use eye contact as important and often intimate, as you might look in the eyes of a loved one. It's key in our communication. We look at each other when we speak. So that dogs look in our eyes might have been appealing to us. And then in turn, it's given them a kind of advantage. They have an entry into our communication. They sort of see what we're looking at. They see when we're talking to them or someone else. And they also get to be part of that feeling that we have, that they have a shared understanding with us, which I think actually makes it easier for us to anthropomorphize them, but makes it easier for us to accept them in our homes.
One of the central themes of your book is something called Umwelt, which we don't have a ton of time to get into, but it's sort of that point of view of the dog, understanding what it's like to live inside of the dog. And that's kind of what all this research points to, is really understanding that. What is the value of understanding that when it comes to living with and training and, you know, transforming a dog from a puppy who's eating all your stuff into a valuable, wonderful, well-behaved member of your family?
It's entirely about Umwelt, I think, like understanding the worldview or the point of view, the perspective of the dog. Everything that we label misbehavior, if understood from what the dog thought they were doing, from the dog's point of view, you can really start to understand where it comes from and how to fix that, what we're calling misbehavior. So I think to understand the perceptual world, you know, what the dogs smell and see, as opposed to what we assume they smell and see, and understand what they know as opposed to what we assume they know, that's how you have a good relationship with a dog.
Okay, Alexandra, one last question, and I am going to go there. My Wheaton Terrier puppy, is it possible that he knows he can get away with stuff because he's so cute?
In some ways, yes, because he's cute, you've let him get away with things. But I doubt he's thinking, what a cute Wheaton I am. He's just looking at you and seeing how you respond.
So he's reflecting my own feelings,
though. That's right.
Well, Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us. This has been fascinating.
Pleasure. Thanks, Rebecca.
Alexandra Horowitz. She's a professor of psychology at Barnard College and the author of Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. For more on her book and for a link to her profile in the current issue of Mental Floss magazine, which you can also get on newsstands, go to wordofmouthradio.org.